You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Matthew Jamieson from the Royal United Services Institute and Mary Dejewski from The Independent will be joining me to discuss today's top stories, from Syria's apparent intervention in Iraq to Libya's election to Uruguay's apparent inability to see what the rest of the world can. Then we'll hear from the documentary director Adalberto Piotto about why he's proud to be Brazilian, as explained in his new film.
Wherever you live, you are still Brazilian. So you need to talk about Brazil. It's your right, but it's your duty as well.
All that, plus our man in Milan, Ivan Cavallo, rounds up the news in Italy, and Alexander Starrett of the Times Literary Supplement reviews the week's good and not so good book releases. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A jam-packed 60 minutes ahead, but before all that, Bill Bingham has the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is warning that his supporters will, as he put it, shake the ground fighting the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. Speaking on Iraqi television, he said he opposed US military assistance to repel the Sunni militants that have overrun large parts of the country and reportedly killed more than 1,000 people. Hundreds of Iraqi villagers have been fleeing attacks by insurgents orchestrated by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS. Government forces have since recovered ground and repelled further assaults on other towns, although it's been reported the offensive has been bolstered by Islamist rebels from Syria joining their counterparts in Iraq. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, who's been holding talks on Iraq with US Secretary of State John Kerry in Paris, says Iraqis must unite to combat the militants' violence.
The ISIL group has shown terrible ferocity and brutality. And we're expecting from the Iraqi that they could get united. It's a necessity not only for Iraq, but for the whole region, because it's a menace for Iraq, for the region, for Europe and for US as well.
Australian officials say they believe the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 was on autopilot over the Indian Ocean until it ran out of fuel. The Boeing 777 vanished on March the 8th with 239 people on board while travelling from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The hunt for the plane has shifted from the intensely searched stretch of the Indian Ocean where an underwater drone had been examining 330 square miles of seabed. The new search area, about 1,100 miles off Australia's west coast, has been chosen after fresh analysis of existing satellite data. US Secretary of State John Kerry has called on Russia to show it's working to disarm separatist militants in eastern Ukraine. He's been speaking to reporters in Paris a day before a ceasefire is due to end in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia denies it has allowed pro-Moscow separatists and heavy weapons to cross its border into eastern Ukraine. The United States and the EU say they'll impose further sanctions if Russia does not do more to defuse the crisis. Mr. Kerry says it's time the separatists agreed to hold talks.
It is critical for Russia to show in the next hours, literally, that they're moving to help disarm the separatists, to encourage them to disarm, to call on them to lay down their weapons and begin to become part of a legitimate political process.
A Jordanian court has acquitted the radical cleric Abu Qatada of charges of conspiracy to bomb an American school in the late 1990s. State media reported that Qatada, whose real name is Omar Othman, was also charged with an attempt to, in 2000, to bomb millennium celebrations in Jordan. He'll remain in jail pending a verdict on that case. Abu Qatada was deported from the UK last year after a long legal battle to force him to leave the country. Qatar Airways has joined Emirates and Etihad in stopping its planes flying to the Pakistani city of Peshawar after a deadly attack on an airliner. The Pakistan International Airlines flight was fired on as it landed on Tuesday, killing a passenger on board. Police have arrested scores of people, but say they do not have full control of areas around the airport where the shots are thought to have originated. Hong Kong's Cathay Pacific says it's suspending all flights to Pakistan. Uruguayan footballer Luis Suarez has been banned for 9 international matches and suspended for 4 months from any football activity by the sport's governing body, FIFA. He's also been fined 100,000 Swiss francs, that's about $111,000. The striker, who plays for the English team Liverpool, has now bitten players 3 times in his career. The latest incident happened in Tuesday's World Cup game against Italy. The punishment is the most severe ever handed out at a World Cup. Suarez does have the right to appeal and is allowed to transfer clubs during the 4-month period. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One at Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London, which will be 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Matthew Jameson, Consultant Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Mary Dajewski from The Independent. Welcome back to you both, indeed. We will start in Iraq. It's unusual to hear the head of a country's government welcoming airstrikes on his own territory by a foreign power, but then little of what has been occurring these last couple of weeks could be described as usual, even by Iraq standards. But Syria has bombed ISIS positions near the border crossing at Qaim, and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says that's just fine with him. Mary, I'll ask you first, is it slightly weird for al-Maliki to be enthusing about this when 57 Iraqi civilians were reported to have been killed in this bombing?
Yes, it is, but it's also indicative of the extraordinary situation that he finds himself in, with pretty much a third, maybe almost a half of his country out of his control. So that may explain why he's more enthusiastic than you might expect.
He is claiming that the strikes were on the Syrian side of the border. Absolutely everybody else, including those who were there, saying otherwise. I suppose he has to say that. I'll ask you, Matthew, is it increasingly obtuse, do you think, to be thinking of Iraq and Syria as separate conflicts? Is this basically now one gigantic, ghastly war raging across these two countries?
I think you have to look at it now in a holistic sense, that there really is virtually now no border between Syria and Iraq, and ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria's main objective is to create a militant Sunni enclave straddling Syria and Iraq. And indeed, what's been happening in Syria has actually probably fueled and given some sense of momentum to the Sunnis in Iraq. I actually think that it's not just a situation of, militant Islamists. This is a situation where the grievances of the Sunni community have been exploited very well and have been manipulated by these Islamic fundamentalists.
Well, I guess it's not dissimilar in that respect to what we saw in Mali, where the grievances, possibly legitimate ones even, of the Tuareg people were hijacked for their own ends by a not dissimilarly inclined gang of militants. There now does appear to be this bizarre queue of people either actually doing or threatening airstrikes against ISIS, whether it is Syria, the United States. It's even been talked of Iran sending drones, which is a really very weird collection of bedfellows we're getting into at this point. Matthew, I'll ask you, that ISIS as a non-state militia, they don't have the jungle cover of the Viet Cong, they don't have the mountains of the Mujahideen. Can they survive a serious air campaign?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because ISIS seems to be a very well-trained, well-equipped group. And it's a good question about just where they're getting all their supplies and training from. Because if you recall, there was only 800 ISIS rebels when they took Mosul against 30,000 troops in the Iraqi National Army.
And to put that in perspective, that's like 800 people seizing control of Birmingham.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that illustrates also also this widespread disenchantment and discontent within the Sunni community towards the Maliki government. And I think really this is very much a sectarian problem. But ISIS has been a very formidable fighting force, so I wouldn't rule anything out when it came to them.
Mary, William Hague is in Baghdad today, adding what pressure he might on al-Maliki to form a more inclusive government, which is something that's supposed to happen next week when Parliament, Iraq's newish parliament, convenes. Al-Maliki is saying this would be like a coup d'etat. Is al-Maliki, is he still a relevant figure at this point, or is really everybody around him just thinking he's yesterday's man and... yeah, he's an obstacle at this point.
Well, I think a lot of people do think that he's an obstacle. I mean, John Kerry was there last week in Baghdad, now William Hague, and you can see the pressure from allies trying to say either you've got to step down or you've got to diversify your administration, you've got to do something. And the continuing relevance of al-Maliki, if you like, is the fact that he's refusing to do that. So he believes, at least, that in the swathe of Iraq that is Shia majority, that he can keep power there. And he may already have written off the Sunni areas and the Kurdish areas. But it appears that for the time being, he is determined to stay in power in Baghdad.
But I suppose al-Maliki, as nominally the Prime Minister of Iraq, can't publicly write off the Sunni and Kurdish areas, even if he has already done that in his head. That would seem like a fairly comprehensive admission of failure if after sort of nearly a decade in office, you've managed to lose the thick end of half the country you started out with.
Yes, but that's the situation that he's in fact facing. And in refusing to diversify his government, as you know, this pressure is on him to do, it looks as though he's almost accepting that. I agree that in the Sunni areas and the fall of Mosul, what we've seen is a huge grassroots opposition to the Shia regime in Baghdad, and the same that's happening in the Kurdish areas. They do not want to be ruled from Baghdad, and so the ISIS forces were able to come in and sweep across the Sunni areas. The question is, can they actually get further south? Can they gain traction in the Shia areas? And probably the answer to that is not.
Is there any chance, and I'll come back to you with this one, Matthew, having, even if what Mary says is correct, that there's only so far ISIS can get, that they probably can't take Baghdad, even if their presence might stir up a certain amount of trouble there, that they can't take especially the Shia areas in the south. Is there any prospect of reversing the gains they have made? The Iraqi army seemed noticeably unwilling to do that. It is very hard to imagine that the Kurdish Peshmerga would see any mileage in trying to recover bits of Iraq outside Kurdistan. The US and the UK have both absolutely emphasized they're not sending meaningful numbers of soldiers. Who else is going to volunteer for this?
Well, indeed. I think that, you look at the Iraqi National Army, and $30 billion at least was spent on it in the United States. And I don't think it was a very good investment, quite frankly, because they just crumbled
well,
and melted away, you know. And then there is, of course, outside backing, maybe perhaps from Iran. The regime in Tehran has come out very strongly in support of the Maliki government. But unfortunately, the Maliki government in Baghdad is part of the problem. Indeed, it has probably been a huge factor in bringing this about. Now, the American intelligence estimates show that the ISIS forces are in control of these vast areas of the country. And it appears that they have the grassroots support of the locals in the community because of the Sunni disenchantment with the regime in Baghdad. So I think that they probably might be able to hold it if they continue to maintain the support of the local people.
The support of the local people, it does seem counterintuitive, but it is an under-discussed part of this phenomenon because, as is often the case, if somebody will impose any kind of order where there was none, then most people will be quite okay with that. I can remember talking to Afghans in Afghanistan under the Taliban in the late 90s, and to all the obvious points I made, which along the lines of like, God, this is awful and no way to live, how do you stand it? The general response I got was, yeah, you should have been here 5 years ago. It was an awful lot worse. Which is about as damning indictment of the al-Maliki government as one might imagine. Mary, I want to come back to William Hague's visit. He, like John Kerry before him, has been very, very emphatic that there will be no meaningful foreign troops coming, etc., which is understandable because it would obviously be politically unsellable back in the home country. Without that commitment, though, how much weight do American Britain's words carry?
Well, very little, because we've seen al-Maliki so far rejecting their words and declining not in pretty much no uncertain terms to do what they're recommending that he does in order to attract their support. Now, there's two things that you can say about that. One of them is that he doesn't think the support is worth having. And the second thing is that they're not offering what he might want in order to do what they want him to do.
Okay, well, we will doubtless be coming back to Iraq, I suspect, because I'm pretty sure this isn't going to get cleared up over the weekend. We will stay more or less in the vicinity, though, where a court in Jordan has acquitted the radical cleric of Abu Qatada of conspiracy to commit terrorist acts. Mr. Qatada will be familiar to British listeners as a popular tabloid bogeyman who spent nearly 20 years as a refugee here in the UK, defying attempts to eject him on the grounds that he might face torture elsewhere. Britain finally succeeded in unloading him last year. Mary, I'll ask you first, there is another judgment against Mr. Qatada due in September. Is this verdict embarrassing to the UK government? Or does the UK government, I suspect actually, to be honest, like most Britons, past caring what happens to Qatada as long as it happens somewhere else?
I think that is true, but at the same time, it is appallingly embarrassing because the British spent years trying to get Abu Qatada to leave the country one way or another. They negotiated this special deal with Jordan that they would put him on trial, that they wouldn't use evidence gained from witnesses by torture. They had this enshrined into a special agreement. Finally, they got through all the hurdles and they extradited him, only to find that he's got off. Now, the problem is that in order to extradite somebody, the other government has to demonstrate that they've got a decent case against them. Otherwise, there's no point in extraditing them. So, to my mind, the British have basically been shown up about three times over here. And the worry for the British, of course, will be that he wants to come back to the UK. And in strictly judicial terms, there's probably no reason why he shouldn't.
The Home Office, it has to be said, have been extremely quick to assert that there is absolutely no chance of that happening. And I suspect he'd be in for a fairly warm welcome all round if he did attempt to come back. Matthew Jameson, if Abu Qatada is as dangerous as we spent 20 years being told that he was, might it have been wiser to keep him here?
Well, from a security point of view, it actually probably would have made a great deal more sense, because at least we'd know where he is, he'd be under our control in our jurisdiction, and we'd be able to keep a very close eye on him. Of course, we've let him go, we wanted him out, and he's back in Jordan, and now a free man in Jordan, it seems like it. So I think really this case once again demonstrates the utter incompetence of the Home Office. And of course, the former Home Secretary John Reid in the Blair government famously said it was not fit for purpose, and it's still not fit for purpose, and that department is in need of serious overhaul.
Mary, was the and you explained very concisely and very neatly there the contortions the British government went through in order to get rid of Abu Qatada. Was this, and this may need a bit of contextualising for non-British listeners, was this just a capitulation to the tabloid and middle market press, for whom, you know, if you were to sit around the features desk at the Daily Mail or the Express to try and dream up a bogeyman, you would come up with Abu Qatada. He's perfect. Is this just the government, you know, throwing them a bone, really?
Well, in one way it is, but in another way, it's actually a very serious case, because the whole time that Abu Qatada was facing extradition to Jordan, the British government was under pressure from a lot of people, including civil rights campaigners in the UK, to say, why don't you put him on trial in the UK? If he's so terrible, if he's such a threat, then put him on trial in the UK. This would be the sensible thing to do. And the government perpetually resisted this, the previous government and the current government. And the reason it is assumed is because the evidence against him, if there is decent evidence against him, would have come from the intelligence services, and that it's evidence of a type that they don't want to divulge, either in open court or probably in closed court either. And without that evidence, they are not confident of securing a conviction. That is why they're so reluctant to put people like Abu Qatada, and not just him, but quite a few people on trial in the UK, and they prefer to have them tried elsewhere.
See, my suspicion was always that the actually dangerous terrorist masterminds are probably the ones that the Daily Mail doesn't know about. is it possible, Matthew Jameson, that this guy was just a cartoon, was just a cipher, and really isn't that big a deal at all?
Well, I think that he obviously was a very unpleasant, malevolent individual. I mean, he was a hate preacher, if you listen to the sermons that he would give in Finsbury Park and so on. And the anti-Semitism and the radical Islamic fundamentalism, it was very disturbing. And there was, of course, an underlying current of trying to whip up division and tension within Muslim communities in Britain. So I feel as though, actually, you know, he was somebody who was a problem. And unfortunately, our legal system is now so contorted that we can't even deal with problems of national security within our own borders.
Well, we shall leave Mr. Qatada to his devices for the moment and move along. This evening's show is something of a Middle East chaos special, but we can only work with what they give us. While the world has been understandably transfixed by the unravelling of Iraq, the unravelling of Libya has continued largely unnoticed. The country held an election yesterday. During that process, the human rights activist Salwa Bougagis was assassinated at her home in Benghazi, one of at least five people killed in separate incidents in Libya's second city. Mary Dujewski, first of all, how significant a figure was she, or I suspect a better question might have been, or might she have become?
I think she was certainly a very significant figure during the Libyan uprising. My impression is that she'd gone a bit quiet, she'd gone a little bit to the back ranks since then. But because Libya is in the throes of drafting a new constitution, getting itself, we hope, some sort of new viable government, then she could have been a very significant player.
Matthew, this is possibly a somewhat fatuous and open-ended question, given that she was a female human rights activist lawyer. But who in a place like Libya would have regarded her as a threat?
Well, I mean, she embodies and represents everything that Islamist militants like ISIS or other militia groups that are in Libya loathe and detest. They can't stand the whole concept of Western human rights and democracy, liberalism,
women,
exactly, yeah. And women rights, and women having positions of authority and power, and taking up professions in society, and so on. They are really dead set against that.
Mary Dujewski, this new parliament, is it likely to change anything? The turnout for the election of it was estimated at somewhere south of 50%. The thing that struck me as interesting was that there does seem to be something of the kind of gesture here that someone like al-Maliki hasn't been able to imagine his way to. The parliament will be based in Benghazi, not Tripoli, as a kind of gesture to national unity.
Yes, the problem is that I wouldn't say that a turnout just short of 50% was actually too bad, given the circumstances. The problem is that even with a parliament in Benghazi, the security situation in Libya is not at all good. And there are very few signs that it's actually going to get any better. I was told just in the last couple of days by somebody from Benghazi, that the situation there was extremely fragile, that it was very, very dangerous, that it was more dangerous than Tripoli. Tripoli, we hear, you've got militias on the loose and in a lot of the rest of the country. I heard a former British diplomat only a month or so ago saying that it would be 10 years before the militia problem was sorted out. Now, none of that bodes well for a new parliament, wherever it's going to be.
Matthew Jameson, just a final thought on Libya. It shouldn't be this hard, should it? It's just 6 million people, huge natural resources. It should be Norway with sunshine.
Well, I think that really after the experience of Iraq, what we're seeing is that nation building is a lot more difficult to do in practice and reality than it is, in the sort of the theory seminar rooms of the Pentagon.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Matthew Jameson from RUSI and Mary Dujewski from The Independent. When we return, we'll be asking how the president of Uruguay can fail to see what is obvious to anyone else with a television.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Matthew Jameson from Rusi, Mary Dejeski from The Independent. Now, Uruguayan striker Luis Suarez can console himself that he has set one record at this World Cup, the longest ban ever given to a player for an on-field misdemeanour at the tournament. Uruguay's president, Jose Mujica, has nonetheless leapt to his defence, saying he didn't see any bite in the shoulder of that Italian defender. Suarez's lawyer, meanwhile, insists that his client is the victim of a European conspiracy, which is presumably the same one that has meant that only half the World Cups ever held have been won by South American teams. The Suarez thing is what it very, very obviously is. I just wondered if there was a wider lesson here, and I'll ask you first, Mary, about the eternal and bewildering ability of people to see what they're determined to see. I mean, the president of Uruguay is saying that there was no bite. This is absurd.
Well, I think if you were the president of Uruguay, you would say exactly the same, because what's at stake is national honour here. And Uruguay is actually on quite a roll at the World Cup, as far as I understand it.
I think is the word you're now looking for.
They've knocked out England, knocked out Italy. So it is a slur on national pride. So, as I say, if I were the president of Uruguay, yeah.
National pride's a funny thing, though, is it? Why can't the president of Uruguay say, "I'm still massively proud to be Uruguayan and I wish our team all the best," but clearly Senor Suarez is perhaps a bit of a jerk?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny, actually. Football and nationalism together are very, very potent things. That actually reminds me about the night after the famous West Germany versus England match in 1990. And Ken Clark was at the cabinet meeting the next morning in Downing Street, and he was lamenting that England had lost. And Mrs. Thatcher said to him, "Oh, don't get too upset about that, Ken. You know, we've already beaten the Germans twice this century at their national sport already."
It is a strange one, though. I mean, there's getting invested in your national team at a World Cup, which is fine. And it was weird for me as an Australian at this World Cup to sort of go into any international sporting event with absolutely no expectation whatsoever that we were going to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Ended up being quite annoying that we actually did reasonably well. but it is odd. A lot of the stories we were discussing earlier in the programme, I think, whether it's Iraq or Libya especially, there is a... This is possibly a bit of a thematic stretch, but there's a tendency in all of them of people like refusing to acknowledge what is patently obvious, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and also what Boris Johnson was saying last week about Tony Blair and the whole Iraq situation, there is this inability sometimes of politicians, of political leaders, to actually acknowledge reality when it's not to their liking.
Do you think they're not acknowledging it to themselves, Mary, or just they're not keen on actually acknowledging reality to the voters?
Well, that's what we don't know, certainly not in the case of Uruguay. I rather suspect that they're not acknowledging it to themselves, that they don't really quite want to believe it, at least not in this situation, at least not this time around. So I think maybe there is some self-delusion there.
The conspiracy theories are hugely entertaining. Other explanations forwarded have suggested that the Italian defender had applied the tooth mark to himself before the game, obviously to unveil it at a convenient moment, or that it was some species of marauding Brazilian insect. There will doubtless be more where they came from. We will have to leave it there for the moment, however. Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute, Mary Dujewski from The Independent, thank you both very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And there's plenty to come up in the second half of today's Midori House. Our man in Milan will run us through the day's news in Italy. We'll ask one film director why he's proud to be Brazilian, because he's just made a film about that very subject. And we'll review the week's best and possibly its worst books. But before we get started on all that, Bill Bingham has the headlines.
Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is warning that his supporters will, as he put it, shake the ground fighting the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. Speaking on Iraqi television, he said he opposed US military assistance to repel the Sunni militants that have overrun large parts of the country and reportedly killed more than 1,000 people. Australian officials say they believe the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 was on autopilot over the Indian Ocean until it ran out of fuel. The hunt for the missing Boeing 777 has shifted from the intensively searched stretch of the Indian Ocean to a new area about 1,100 miles off Australia's west coast. US Secretary of State John Kerry has called on Russia to show it's working to disarm separatist militants in eastern Ukraine. He's been speaking to reporters in Paris a day before a ceasefire is due to end in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. A Jordanian court has acquitted the radical cleric Abu Qatada of charges of conspiracy to bomb an American school in the late 1990s. State media reported that Qatada was also charged with an attempt in 2000 to bomb millennium celebrations in Jordan. He'll remain in jail pending a verdict on that case. And Qatar Airways has joined Emirates and Etihad in stopping its planes flying to the Pakistani city of Peshawar after a deadly attack on an airliner. The Pakistan International Airlines flight was fired on as it landed on Tuesday, killing one passenger on board. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill, and welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow and it's 19:32 in Milan, which is where we're going now to check in with our correspondent, Ivan Cavalho. Ivan, welcome to the programme.
Good evening, Andrew.
The Prime Minister, I understand, first of all, you want to talk about, is meeting with Beppe Grillo and Five Star. First of all, a bit of background. Since Five Star became a thing and then suddenly seemed to be less of a thing, how much of a presence in Italian politics are they now?
Well, it's interesting. Yesterday, Renzi met with members of Beppe Grillo's party, not Beppe Grillo himself. Several months ago, there was a very infamous meeting that lasted just a few minutes that was streamed on the internet between the two, where Grillo says that, you know, you're not credible. I can't enter into talks with you. I'm going to stay on the outside. I'm going to resist any kind of policies from you. Now, because of the recent European elections, Renzi came out with 40% of the vote. He's offered an olive branch with Grillo. He didn't appear at the talks yesterday, but he sent deputies from the parliament, from his party. And Renzi was open to some suggestions about this electoral law, which has been dragging on in terms of trying to reform so Italy can have a governable coalition and not these sort of messy, sticky grand coalitions that we've seen that have led to very short governments.
What kind of price are Five Star going to be looking for in return for cooperation?
Well, you know, they're hoping that that Renzi will, in terms of, because, you know, Renzi's also talking about economic growth, and so they're hoping to maybe dent some of the initiatives. They've been known and on the record for wanting certain things like utilities, water, and other things to be made public. And that's something that Grillo brought up in their first meeting. So in terms of some of the economic reforms, because Renzi is seen, even though he's the center-left party, he's seen as to be more quite centrist, even center-right in some cases, if you talk to people on the street. And so there might be some trading, horse trading going on there. They seem to be, Renzi's party seem to be receptive about, with the voting law, about having voters being able to select their own candidates instead of these sort of blocked lists. We'll have to see in the coming days and weeks, you know, how it develops in terms of the draft and how it might change. Because Berlusconi was in agreement with Renzi before, and he's sort of now, and his Forza Italia people are saying, you know, look, this is what we agreed upon last year, and so that could lead to some disruptions for Renzi.
Okay, well, we shall move along now to some local politics in Rome, where I understand that crossing the street in Rome, which has always been something of a gamble, is about to become a little bit safer.
Yeah, well, if you recall, Andrew, Roman Holiday, the film with Audrey Hepburn, Gregory Peck, and a lot of the scenes when she's a tourist and being shown around on the Vespa and having pictures taken. Well, Ignazio Marino, the mayor of Rome, wants to have that sort of sightseeing done almost exclusively on foot now, because you know, he's a surgeon, so he's a physician, and he wants to see people out walking. And Rome's traffic is quite notorious. I mean, there are estimates about how many cars per people. It's almost one car per person. So we're talking about almost levels of like California. But of course, as you know, the center of Rome, there's not a lot of space for today's automobiles. The infrastructure, you can't build metros and tram lines like you could elsewhere, because if you dig for a few minutes, you will find possibly Etruscan ruins, and that stops work for a long time. So Marino has a quite extensive program he wants to do. He wants to the Spanish Steps. He wants to make that pedestrian-free. Last year, he did it with an area around the Colosseum. And he's hoping that that will make it, you know, even more tourist-friendly for people to walk around, have their ice cream, and be able to see the sights without, you know, the exhaust and the horns blaring.
Is this going to be a broadly popular move with Romans?
Well, you know, he wants to also reintroduce bike sharing, which the previous mayor, Alamano, tried to do. Alamano was from the center-right, and Marino was from Renzi's party. Alamano didn't have much success with this bike sharing. There was vandalism. There's about 30 of these bike sharing stations set up. He wants to double that. He wants to expand it. It's going to be curious to see the response from locals. Maybe he's going to try to get more tourists involved. I mean, in terms of the money, he's got funds. There are of course luxury companies, luxury goods companies like Tod's, supporting the restoration of the Colosseum, the Spanish Steps, actually where he wants to have a pedestrian zone. The Roman jeweler Bulgari is putting up money. Interestingly, recently over the weekend there was a concert by the Rolling Stones in Circus Maximus, and Marino noted that the current laws on the books, the city only paid, was only given 8,000 euros for the actual site. So you can rent for a rock concert, a 2,000-year-old archaeological treasure, and for only 8,000 euros. Of course, you have to pay other fees for trash collection and police. But that's such a low fee, he's saying that we need to change these laws, because if we had a Rolling Stones concert, say, in Hyde Park, just the fee itself would be several hundred thousand pounds. So, you know, he has to really look at the books and get these funds going, and maybe he can have a go at this bike sharing that will actually work.
Ivan Cavallo in Milan, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Each year, Monocle publishes its ranking of the top 25 cities for quality of life. These most livable cities in the world get the essentials right, and for 2014, Copenhagen scores a hat trick as Monocle's number one city for the third time.
All of the Nordic capitals, they're incredibly close, there's no question, and they all do a number of things incredibly well. But there's something about Copenhagen. It's just that little bit further south, and it's just a bit looser around the edges. There's a little bit more license to do things, maybe on your own terms.
Monocle takes a cinematic look at the top cities in our 2014 Quality of Life survey, now showing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, when visiting Brazil, you might frequently hear the expression, the pride of being Brazilian. Documentary maker Adalberto Piotto decided to make a documentary about that emblematic phrase. In his film, he interviews renowned Brazilians, including former President Fernando Henrique Cardoso and environmentalist Marina Silva, as he discusses his search for Brazilian pride. Adalberto was in London for a special presentation of his documentary in partnership with Culture Art, an organisation that helps to promote Brazilian culture in the UK. He came into Midori House and spoke to Monocle's resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Adalberto, well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and it's interesting to discuss about your film, especially during this period for Brazil, all the world is looking at us because of the World Cup. I wonder, the film is called Proud to be Brazilian. Are Brazilians in general a proud bunch of people?
I cannot say if people are proud about being Brazilian, but I think they have a pride to be Brazilian because they think they have to do something about the country. They have to fix the country. Of course, the wrong things. But I'm sure that things are changing in my country. You know, you're Brazilian like me, so you're speaking in English, but you're Brazilian. And I think people are changing a lot about, if you compare, of course, 20 years ago, now things are better. It started when the economy in Brazil, we were stabilizing. We have a currency stabilization in the beginning of the 90s. And it was fantastic because you know how things are. When you don't have a very fantastic atmosphere in Brazil, when you have democracy, when you have currency stabilization, you don't know where you are. When you have this, you have a new perception about your country. So I think things are changing in the country. But okay, we have a long way to improve the country.
One thing that I'm very curious, you even write in the synopsis that Brazilians, I think they're divided sometimes in two. Sometimes we have this inferiority complex with other nations. But at the same time, sometimes we say Brazilians are the best people in the world. So it's quite a contradiction, no?
Yeah, that's my point in my film. Yeah, I want to discuss this, but in a real way. I think this is the main point about my theme, the plot. Because we have this contradiction. Sometimes we think we are the best people in the world. We are the best country in the world, and we are not. And sometimes, maybe on Monday, after a very sunny Sunday, we think that we are the worst people in the world, the worst country in the world, the worst nation, and we are not as well. I think we need to perceive that we have good things and we have feel proud about these things. On the other hand, we need to fix what is wrong. Because if not, you have all the time to give excuses about, oh, Brazil is marvelous, but we have social problems. Okay, fix the social problems. Concentrate yourself to solve that problems. Because they have solution. It's not impossible to fix this kind of problem. But you have to put your attention, you have to put all your efforts to solve the problem. But concentrate yourself on bad things to make this better. I think it's just a way to improve ourselves.
And talking about the film, I mean, you have such an amazing people that you interviewed, from former President Fernando Henrique Cardoso to very important people in Brazil.
Yeah.
I mean, can you tell us, how did you manage to talk to all those people?
It was quite difficult. But difficult in... Not too difficult, because I used to believe that people, there's a lot of people in Brazil that wanted to talk about Brazil with a very transparent atmosphere. But they need that you make the real questions. A true question has a true answer. So when I asked them to have a participation, my team as a respondent, and they said, okay, I like the project. Yeah. If you want to talk about Brazil in a serious way, not with using stereotypes, yes, I'm ready. And I think we did. Yeah. We made a movie. I think it's not my movie. It's a movie of everyone who wants to talk about Brazil in a real way.
And I like that you also interviewed Brazilians living abroad. And I mean, we were discussing before that you received some criticism of that. But I thought it was a great idea, because nevertheless, they are still Brazilians, no?
Yeah, because wherever you live, you are still Brazilian. So you need to talk about Brazil. It's your right, but it's your duty as well. So I gave them the opportunity to talk and to give us their impression about Brazil. Because when you live abroad, you know, when you live overseas, when you live in another country, you see something with another perspective. So it's good for a film, because I would like in the first moment to have as many perspectives as possible. And I think the film gives this a lot of perspectives.
And during the film also, I mean, there's our national anthem is played quite a lot.
Oh,
what
yeah.
is the importance of our national anthem to you? Can you tell us more about it?
First, I really love the national Brazilian anthem. Absolutely. And I was very young in 1985 when former President Tancredo Neves died. And we had in that time a marvelous performance of National Anthem by Fafá de Belém. I don't know if you remember, because he was very young. But after that moment, I thought, okay, I can use this again in another way, because the moment is different. If you compare this moment to 1985, we are maybe facing a new democracy in Brazil in that time. Now we are just thinking about better things, not democracy we have, so we need more. And the national anthem is just a link between the interviews, talking about Brazil, and this is the song. I used to say that this is the artistic part of a documentary. I had the national anthem to give me this link. I think it's link, the best way to define.
Are you proud of being Brazilian?
I'm proud, absolutely. I'm proud to be Brazilian and to keep trying to do my best for my country.
That was the director Adalberto Piotto, director of Proud to be Brazilian. For more information on the film and its next screenings, go to orgulhodoc.com.br. That's probably best off spelling that out, orgulhodoc.com.br. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for a bit of music. We just heard there from Adalberto Piotto about why he's proud to be Brazilian. So we will stay in Brazil for a track hailing from the Bexiga neighborhood in Sao Paulo. This is Bexiga 70's Kalimba. That was Bexiga 70 with Kalimba. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to take our daily look at the best, sometimes the worst, as it happens, of the arts. Today we're talking books, and I'm joined now by literary critic for the Times Literary Supplement, Alexander Starrett. Alexander, welcome to the show. We were going to start with Nicholson Baker's new one, Travelling Sprinkler. Nicholson Baker writes fiction and non-fiction. In my admittedly variable judgment, at least, he does rather better with the fiction than the non-fiction.
I think that's probably fair. And I think he also writes two very different kinds of fiction. One is these sort of exuberant sex novels, which are the more famous ones. There's one called Vox, for example, which is just a kind of conversation between a phone sex conversation between two people. That's the whole novel. And Monica Lewinsky famously gave it to Bill Clinton. So it was named during the...
You can't buy that kind of publicity.
Exactly. So that's what he's famous for. But the other kind of novels, I think, are actually the better ones, where he sort of examines daily life in a very microscopic detail.
And is that what he's doing here?
Yeah, that's exactly what Travelling Sprinkler is. He's kind of invented this alter ego called Paul Chowder.
Who has appeared before.
Who's appeared in a book called The Anthologist, which was two books ago, I think. And he's a sort of 55-year-old poet. He's a lot like Nicholson Baker. And in this novel, he's essentially decided to give up on poetry and become a bassoonist. And we sort of...
As one does.
As one does, of course. An instrument that he last played as a 20-year-old. So we see a lot of his navel-gazing. But it does relate to the non-fiction books, which are largely political, in that this novel sort of introduces the question, is it enough to be a good man? Is it enough for him to be good in his personal life?
Or do you need to be a good poet and bassoonist as well?
But also, do you need to engage with the world outside your own little sphere of poetry and bassoon? Do you need to read the newspapers and care about what happens in them?
Does he, without giving away the endings, reach any firm conclusions? Because I'm asking this as somebody who's liked things Nicholson Baker has written, but hasn't quite yet forgiven him for Human Smoke, which was his extremely silly book about the beginnings of the Second World War.
Yeah, I have to say I've avoided Human Smoke for that reason.
I would totally carry on doing exactly that. I made the mistake of thinking, that sounds like an interesting premise.
An interesting premise, yeah. But yeah. Well, in this one, he sort of, he does reach a conclusion. I suspect you wouldn't like it. In that he's sort of weighing up whether to write a love song or a protest song. And he comes to some conclusions about the nature of protest songs as the making art of art as a way of being in the world.
But can we at least think of this as Nicholson Baker at his best? Which is, because he can be very funny.
Yeah, I think this is his best. Absolutely. Okay. This and the other Paul Chowder book, The Anthologist, I think are fantastic. I mean, I've liked the other work, but this, I think, is where he's really found the voice that lets him do what he's doing.
Is it because, do you think, that he uses the Paul Chowder character kind of as a way to tell a joke against himself and therefore gets away from the pomposity that rather interferes with his non-fiction?
I think that's exactly it. In the early fiction, for example, The Mezzanine, his first one, which all takes place, the whole novel is one guy going up an escalator. It's very funny, it's very clever, but it's also kind of boring, you know? Whereas Paul Chowder is such an engaging guy.
He must write an amazing book proposal. Yeah. About a guy going up an elevator.
Yeah.
We should move along to Hermonier's Viper Wine, which has been out for a couple of months. She used to write for The Independent on Sunday before they fired everybody who wrote about the arts at The Independent on Sunday. Has also been at the Evening Standard magazine. Is this her first novel?
It is her
first novel. I thought so. Journalists doing novels, it's something that they usually get around to sooner or later. Is it any good?
It's extremely good. And it's not a typical journalist novel at all. You know, the typical journalist novel is like very pacey, very high concept.
And very, very often about a journalist somewhat more handsome and better paid than the actual
exactly.
journalist writing it.
Of course. It's always, the next Watergate.
Or there's the ones I enjoy much more, which are the really thinly veiled score settling with everybody who's ever tried to impede them.
Yeah.
This is not like that?
No. It's not like that. In fact, it couldn't be less like that. It's a historical novel. It's set in 1632. And it's about this woman called Venetia Digby, who was a real woman, who was the great beauty of her age, so beautiful that after she died, her husband had Van Dyck paint her on her deathbed. And it's about her attempts in her later life, her middle age, to maintain her beauty, because the lead makeup that they wore in Caroline, England, rotted the face. So it's all about her kind of mad attempt.
The metaphor kind of writes itself there. Is it a successful? I mean, there's an obvious meditation there on the nature of beauty, mortality, etc. All the greats. Is it a successful evocation of 17th century Britain?
In a sense, but I mean, it's highly unusual. There's a kind of exuberance in it. It's not kind of Hilary Mantel style domestic realism at all. What she's done is that Venetia's husband is a kind, his mind is an antenna almost that picks up things from all times, from the future. So we get him tuning in to bits of Naomi Campbell or we get him eating bacon and eggs and wagon wheels, or being interviewed when he comes back from a voyage by Michael Parkinson and Jonathan Ross. You know, it's a kind of...
Not rigorous on the historical detail.
But there's like, it's kind of gleeful. That's what's wonderful about it. Instead of the plodding nature of a lot of historical fiction, you know, where you say, this is absolutely the kind of culotte that they would have worn on this day. I mean, who cares? Instead, it has this incredible, this energy and vitality and this great humour above all.
Well, that sounds like rather fun. That's Viper Wine by Hermione Iyer, which is out now. Finally, Jonathan Beckman, assistant editor of the Literary Review at The Guardian, his novel, How to Ruin a Queen.
It's not a novel, actually.
Sorry, not a novel. Yeah. It's a non-fiction biography of a necklace.
Yeah, that's exactly it. A biography of an incredible con, above all, in that this chancer, a woman called Jeanne de la Motte, convinced one of the most powerful people in France that she was acting on behalf of Marie Antoinette to purchase a necklace in secret. A necklace so expensive that France could not afford to buy it and go to war at the same time.
Tricky choice.
Yeah, and somehow she pulled this off and convinced this guy that all he needed to do to win the Queen's favour was pick up this necklace for her, give it to Jeanne de la Motte, and then never say anything about it again.
That sounds intriguing as well. I'm a particular fan of a great con trick, and of course Paris itself has hosted several of them. That was where Count Victor Lustig sold the Eiffel Tower twice. For the moment, thank you very much, Alexander Starrett from the TLS. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Matthew Jameson from RUSI, Mary Dajewski from The Independent. Today's show is produced by Alla John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Laux, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Up after the headlines, we'll have The Urbanist, presented this week by David Michon. At 2200, I will be back with Georgina Graham with the Monocle Daily, and this show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.